welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan, and wow, I am excited for you to hear this interview. I got to chat with the absolutely incredible Bethany C. Morrow. She's the author of several incredible books, including Mem and A Song Bowl of Water, and I am thrilled to have been able to talk with her about her latest social horror novel, Cherish Farah, which I'm still processing weeks after reading it. One of these days, I'll get my thoughts together enough to perfect my elevator pitch for it, but for now, I just have to say, trust me on this one, it's one of the best novels of the year. But enough intro for now. Let's get into my interview with Bethany C. Morrow.
Hi, Bethany C. Morrow.
Hello, Ryan.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. As you know, yes. And I apologize for all of the notifications.
That is the most fun part of the lead up to the launch. And the launch is just a deluge of messages and excitement. And finally knowing that there are some people I can talk to about this book.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I can't wait to... A, hand sell it, but then B, have people finish it so that I can be like, so,
right.
What'd you think? Because this book, I'm still processing it like a week later. I can't. And we'll get into that in a minute. For the listeners who haven't read it yet, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Cherish Farah.
I can tell you what you will think the story is about when you start reading the book. So Cherish Farah is adult market. I really want to be clear about that because it has two teenage protagonists, but it is not something to be given willy-nilly to teenagers unless you've read it yourself and know them very well. So it takes place in a very white country club community in which there are only two Black girls. One of them is named Farah. The other is her best friend, Cherish, but only Farah has Black parents because Cherish is a transracial adoptee and she's been raised by the Whitmans. When I say she's been raised by Whitmans, those are her parents. And so Farah is, as you quickly discover, because you're in a kind of claustrophobic relationship with her as the reader, she is your POV character. She is troubled, and in her own words, she is cosplaying a teenager. And she obviously has a budding psychopathy. I do say obviously, I realize that there are certain people who are going to rehabilitate as they read and just like try to make something make sense with what they're used to. And I don't know how you could get through this whole book doing that, but
yep.
Props if you can, because she is not a regular teenager. And very early on, she tells you that Cherish is the only person that she loves, even when she hates her, and she means that. That's an accurate thing to say. And so what we find is that Farah is going through a very destabilizing period of her life where her parents have been foreclosed on, and their entire position in this very affluent community is changing in a way that really is uniquely true for racialized minorities, where there's a huge wealth disparity, there's a huge generational wealth disparity. So the safety nets that white Americans take for granted or are accustomed to do not exist for this family. They are, potentially the first of their family to live this way. And there just aren't safety nets for that. The problem is that Farah is very concerned with control and being in control of her surroundings, being in control in relationships. And she is extremely destabilized by this. And she sort of accepts an open-ended invitation into the Whitman home during this time. And then sort of decides, okay, well, I choose this. And in deciding that, she begins to do the necessary performances to ingratiate herself into this family, despite the fact that it starts to become pretty evident that there are strange things happening and she might not be the only person who has a reason for wanting her there.
Yeah. Yeah, this book, and my husband can attest to this, I, read the first half thinking it was one thing, and then I got to a certain point, and I had hands covering, I'm like reading the book with one hand over my face, pacing my, and I am a horror reader. So like things don't affect me usually. I was like this, like, oh my God, oh my, no, what, no, what? And I finished it and just sort of slumped to the floor and just laid down on the floor for like 10 minutes. And my husband was like, so what happened? And I was like, you need to give me a minute.
Right. Cannot discuss.
Still processing. Right. You gotta give me a minute. In the best way. It is phenomenal. It is unlike anything I've ever read. And I noticed it is, it's being called a social horror, which is a term that I love. And I think this is the first time I've seen it. I don't know if it's been attributed to other things. It's the first time I remember seeing it. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your understanding of what social horror is, as opposed to just sort of general horror.
Right. And this is really important because when I sold this book, I told them this is social horror.
Okay.
So the first thing, of course, that it's called, that it would be called, was like a psychological thriller or something like that. And I'm like, right, but this is real specifically a social horror. And I would really like to get people familiar with that term and what it means. And what it means for me is a horror that depends on the sociological context in which we find ourselves and deals with that. So the most famous thing that people would understand, of course, is Get Out. Mm-hmm. This is a social horror. The horror is based on existing sociological dynamics. And that's true of Cherish Farah. And we have seen, because here's the thing, it's not new, particularly for Black American creators. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it's new. I think that bringing it, giving it its home space and sort of centralizing it is what's new and making sure that people understand what specifically this is. In order to engage with the horror, you have to be willing to tell the truth about the society. Yeah. And that's, you know, the most genius to me in a genius movie, the most genius part of Get Out is the fact that the final scare are police lights. You don't get to be scared if you deny state violence against Black Americans. You don't get to partake. You don't get to engage. You don't get to enjoy this if you insist on maintaining your delusion and maintaining this lie and this gaslighting. So I, of course, as somebody whose personal brand across all categories and genres is Indicting the American Imagination, I love social horror because it is, by its nature, by its definition, it is indicting, and it refuses to allow you to lie about reality, because if you truly don't get it, you'll have no idea what's going on in this book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it sort of tells on the reader.
Yeah. No, I love that. There was when the publicists were sending the materials prior to this interview, there was a paragraph at the beginning that had a couple of quotes that I initially read and I was like, oh, interesting. And then I finished the book and I was like, oh, yep. And it was, you know, they're describing the book, A Wickedly Smart Thriller, and an unflinching look at how good liberal white people are frighteningly complicit in manufacturing trauma for Black people. And then it goes on to talk about how it highlights the hypocrisy in so many progressive characters. And so, like, you know, initially I read that and I was like, oh, cool, this will be an interesting premise. And I finished the book and I was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep.
Because even, and obviously no spoilers, I won't name any names and I won't get into too specific things, but there are moments where there are white characters almost explaining the Black experience to Black characters. And I was like, excuse you.
Yeah.
You think you're doing a good thing here. And
Yeah. Because what we usually get, and what have been, I mean, celebrated for so long, and you have to remember that they're celebrated to the exclusion of Black-centered and Black-told stories involving Black people, are these white savior narratives. And we think that's what good white people look like. Now, if you understood what whiteness is, and that it's a power conglomerate created for the sole purpose of subjugating and dehumanizing another people group, you would realize that the only way to be quote unquote good would be to be actively working on dismantling it, right?
Yeah.
But instead we create all of these little we create all of these little hideouts for people to both benefit and profit from, and also deny awareness of, or figure out some other way to virtue signal that they're one of the good ones. And it's like, there's no such thing as good while this exists. And therefore, if we look closer, if we scratch the surface of even that person, we're going to find terrorization. The wonderful thing about Cherish Fair is the whole premise of the book is careful when they change their minds, which of course is a quote from a Langston Hughes poem called Warning. Mm-hmm. As we watch all these horrible things continue to happen in the United States, and particularly in the last couple of years, and as the not mask, but hood has like mm-hmm. fully been removed, you more and more, and I think Kimberly Jones said it in a very sort of visceral and sort of, it was just a electrifying off the cuff interview where she said that white supremacy should be glad that we're seeking equality and not revenge. Mm. And so the premise for me of Cherish Fair, and the reason it would be interesting for me, is what if you chose the wrong one?
Yeah.
What happens when the person you're terrorizing is perfectly willing and capable of terrorizing you back? Mm-hmm. And are you actually equipped for that fight? And who ends up winning that? So that to me was, I mean, I absolutely loved that. I absolutely loved it. Because there's only so many times that you can watch people who literally just lost their loved ones to state violence or to white supremacist violence, which is, most of the violence in this country should actually be considered a hate crime,
yeah.
But it's not. And you watch people be twisted into mouthpieces for sort of calling for unity, and unity is always dependent on the person being stabbed. Like, I'm supposed to ensure unity. I'm supposed to, you know, not talk about what's being done to me because that's divisive. What you're doing to me is fine. It's me talking about it that's a problem, right? And there's only so much you can handle about seeing people grieving the very personal trauma, but the very socially present trauma, that are the horrifying tradition that they become a part of, and having no place for anger, and having no place for vengeance, and having no place. And I'm like, you know, mm-hmm. everybody's got a limit. Yeah. And it's important, especially in literature, especially as somebody who, you know, cares about any of this and just ridiculously cares about this country for no reason. It's given me no reason to care about it. To tell people, careful when we change our minds. Like, if you can only see violence when it's responding to violence, which by definition is self-defense, then you're saying that there's only one solution. Is that what you want to say?
Right. Yeah. 100%. And this book is brilliant, and I hope will make lots of people very uncomfortable.
I am so, it sounds terrible, but of course I wrote a social horror. I want people to be horrified, but it's so fun to like the reactions, all of the notifications that I got from you. Just,
oh my God.
You're so wonderful.
I was losing it. In the best way. Yeah.
And it just warms my heart.
Yeah. Your reactions back to my reactions just had me cackling. I was like, mm-hmm, yep, she's loving this. Okay. So let's talk about Cherish and Farah. I love these characters so much. They are incredible. Their relationship together is so fascinating. You should see the notes I was taking while reading this.
I would love to.
it's so like unhinged. But one of the things I wrote down was that they were cruelly intimate. Mm-hmm. They trust each other implicitly to the point of harm. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. They are fascinating characters. And I would love to just hear you talk more about them, both as the best friends that they are together, their relationship, but also separately, because they're so different.
They are. And that's how you know something else is going on, because on the surface, honestly, if we can just, you know, if we can talk about the kind of toxically intimate relationships that teen girls can have, that's not uncommon, right? Like, you know, people always want to act like the most intense relationships you have as a teenager are romantic. And that's not my experience, and it's not the experience of a lot of my current girlfriends. Mm-hmm. We have sort of the whole world against us, pitted against us as teenage girls. You know, you have the misogyny, you have either the infantilization or the adultification, you have the hypersexualization, you have the puritanical restrictions, you have the, you know, you're just at, and also while all of that is happening, your brain's not fully formed. I'm right. Sorry. Like right. You're literally not finished baking. And you also, before your brain is finished, your reproductive system is, mm-hmm. which means that chemically every single month, if you are someone who has a cycle, you're going through something that, because people don't want to make proper concessions for people with uteruses and people who menstruate, they would rather reduce it socially to the point that children say, oh, this person's PMSing. Do you know what that is? Do you, like, because right? I took female physiology, and when I took female physiology in university, I was like, why am I expected to do anything, just physical stuff, you know, aside, just literally what's happening in my brain. This is like just like going through major surgery every single month, just for the majority of your life. Yep. And because the power dominant, you know, identity isn't going through it, you just have to pretend it's nothing. And that is wild. But so all of this is happening at the same time that you are just completely dehumanized and diminished for just this huge chunk of your, you know, sort of like foundational identity creation and solidification, right? Mm-hmm. It's not shocking that teen girls can fuse and can build these almost competitively intense, competitively loyal, competitively adoring and demanding relationships when we are the only people who take us seriously. So, you know, they're constantly trying to prove and affirm this connection that nobody's challenging.
Right. right.
Like, their family and friends are very like, yes, you guys are Cherish and Farah. We get it. Like, you love each other more than anybody. So there's no dissent, but they're constantly competitively, aggressively defending it. Yeah. And I hate to say it, but that's literally just a normal relationship. Yeah, so yeah. What makes their relationship sort of electrified is being the only two Black girls in this place, one of them being raised by seemingly perfect and progressive and socially aware white parents who are going through, you know, who've taken classes and made sure that she has a Black pediatrician and for all the right reasons and everything. So you've got all of these experts and, you know, people who seem to know who believe that they know what's best for you. And you both know that you're the only two people who know what this is like what your lives are like from in terms of their race, in terms of their gender. You know, so it's their intersections are so precise and are so rare in the setting that they're in, that it creates this much more, it adds a layer of intensity even on the intensity. But for Farrah, she is, like I said, she's not a normal teenager to begin with. And so she saw Cherish, you know, before Cherish ever saw her. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to work out, is this person really as simple as they appear?
Mm-hmm.
Because her life traversing that gauntlet has, you know, has been costly in a way she understands, has been difficult in a way that she's aware of. And Cherish did not seem to know any of the things that she knows. And there's only one explanation for why Cherish doesn't know what she doesn't know, obviously. Mm-hmm. And because of that, Farrah realizes, I can get inside of her in a way nobody else can. And I can own her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can make her mine. And Cherish, for all she doesn't know, understands that Farrah is the only person who can really know her. And so she, from her side, agrees and is attached to this relationship. Even as she, you know, I always call her my Frank Grimes character. She's my audience insert character. She's much less sinister, and she's not as complex mentally. She's not as strategic and cunning as everybody else. And so she picks up on things much more slowly than everyone right. else. But then the question is, how meaningful and how necessary is this connection? Even as you do come to realize things, what do you want? Like, right. what do you actually need?
Yeah, I love Cherish so much. And I love that there's definitely a few moments where she'll just be kind of like looking around
like what's happening?
What is going on? Why are you acting like this?
Right.
And she'll literally be like, Farrah, something's wrong with
right,
you.
Right.
She's, why are you saying these things?
She is. I love her. I love her so much, because if anyone means her harm, she really has no, she has like no armor. She has yeah. no recourse, because she's so undeveloped.
Yeah.
She has that arrested development that comes from that type of coddling.
Yeah.
And a type of coddling that was never meant for her. So she is just, she's completely, and Farrah also is like, okay, you created this masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You don't see all of the downfalls. I have to take care of this person.
Yeah. 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 Farrah is definitely like, no, she needs me. Even yeah. if she doesn't realize she needs me, even if you guys don't realize she needs me.
Right.
I love that she calls her white girl spoiled. Like, she's right. Like, 'cause she is.
And she is. And it's like, that sounds like a sort of like harmless term of endearment, unless you recognize how cunning and how incisive Farrah actually is. She's saying something really devastating.
Yeah.
But she's able to say it to her face.
Yeah.
Because Cherish doesn't know what it means. Like.
Yeah. And I love Farrah is so fascinating. It's so, so incredible being in her head this whole novel, because she, there is something, you know, I almost said serial killer-esque. She's not a serial killer. She's a sociopathic-esque.
I mean, we see.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see.
She's
we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
She's a baby. But being in her head and seeing the way she sees the world and the way she talks about her mask and how, you know, she has to make sure that her mask is in place. And when it does slip and she's like, okay, but they didn't notice. Okay. Like, what was it like writing Farrah and being in that headspace writing Farrah?
I mean, this is probably the wrong answer, but it's very comfortable.
Okay.
Farrah is very consistent, and she doesn't intentionally lie to herself. So the average person is an escape artist, and doesn't, you know, like the average person doesn't know themselves, even themselves, as well as they think they do. So it would be very difficult for them to really know other people. And Farrah makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. The difference is she doesn't really have any empathy.
Right.
And so the thing about writing her is it feels very natural at different points that where she goes. It's just that she doesn't stop. It's just that like she's unrelenting because this is who she really consistently is. And it's important, no matter who your character is, that they never sort of, you never sacrifice them for your own ease or for the ease of the story. And it wouldn't have been possible. You can't break, if you break Farrah even a little, the reader is going to be like, oh, okay, I'm awake. Like I'm completely out of the story. So in that way, it was difficult and easy because it was like, I have to maintain who Farrah is all the way through. Otherwise, none of this makes sense. Mm-hmm. And otherwise the reader is, it's going to be so alarming because she's so singular. She's so atypical that if she breaks, the reader is going to see it immediately in a way that they might not pick it up in a different character. If you have moments of inconsistency, and I don't mean in the way that regular humans are inconsistent, but literally like, this doesn't fit their self-narrative. This doesn't fit the narrative they have about the world. This is, you've broken them now because you wanted to do something. If I did that even with Cherish, I don't know that the reader would notice.
Right.
But Farrah is so specific that if you break even for a second, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Well, we're almost at the end, and I know that you have a very busy day of interviews and such. But before we wrap up, I wondered if there were any books that you had read recently that you wanted to shout out and recommend.
Everybody, of course, is asking me this all day, and I feel like I have to disappoint every single one of you and tell you that the pandemic has stolen my ability to seemingly finish books. I will say that I received, and I don't know what I have to do to make my brain stop turning off, but whatever it is, I will figure it out, because Lisa Cross Smith's new arc got to me, and Half-Blown Rose,
okay, I believe
the name, and her previous book, This Close to Okay, was just like the warm bath that I needed. It was just so perfect. It was so gorgeous. It's like when you hear a song and it's like, oh, I can only listen to this song for like, cause nothing else is going to sound like it. It's so pitch perfect. That's what This Close to Okay was. So I'm so excited about this one. I also just got Zora Neale Hurston's essay collection, You Don't Know Us Negroes. And I read the first couple of essays, and it's just, it's just absolutely beautiful. Her melody, her storytelling, the authenticity of her storytelling and the way that she weaves folklore, even in these essays, it's just absolutely gorgeous. So those are two things of many that I'm extremely excited about, and I don't know when I will finish them. It's the pandemic's fault.
Totally. Brain fog is such a thing. We talk about it all the time on here, and we're all struggling with it. So relatable. Well, I thank you. Thank you so much for being on here. I am so excited to finally be able to shove this in customers' hands because, yay, oh my God.
Don't even explain anything. Just like, oh my God, take it.
Just trust me, which is essentially what my review boiled down to. Just trust me. Bethany, thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of your launch week and have an awesome day.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Huge thanks again to Bethany C. Morrow for joining me on the podcast. Cherish Farrah is available now. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And I'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books that were mentioned during this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks. Bye!